Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Coming up, Grain News editor Carrie Belanger will be speaking to nutrient agronomist Christy Preston about fall fertilizer management. Markets Farm's Glenn Halleck will tell us about the latest action in commodities, and Country Guide's Lorraine Stevenson will fill us in on COVID and food insecurity in Canada. But first, here's Karen Briere of the Western Producer to tell us about a lot of combines that have been going up in flames this fall. Karen, thanks for making the time to join us. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Gord.
So it's already been a bad season for combine fires. What's causing that?
Well, there could be numerous reasons, obviously, but the main ones I've heard about seem to be the August heat and lentil dust. Most of the fires I heard about were in lentil fields earlier in the harvest season. The temperature then was in the mid-30s for a couple of weeks. And lentil dust is, as I'm sure most farmers know, highly combustible. The closer it is to hot combine parts in low humidity and wind, the more likely it is to ignite a fire or explode. So that's an obvious source. On the equipment side, bearing failure, electrical shorts, sparks from the combine, and things like fuel lines can all cause fires.
So do we have any kind of a handle on how many more there have been as opposed to sort of a quote, usual year?
We don't. And it may seem like this year is unusual. It may not be, because most of what we hear is anecdotal. Often the fires aren't reported to authorities. They're put out by themselves, the producers themselves, with the help of their neighbors. For example, I had heard anecdotally that in one weekend there were 6 fires north of Assiniboia and 6 to the south. But when I spoke to the fire chief, the department had only been called to one of them. And I did hear that southern Alberta in the Medicine Hat area had reported a fair number of fires in combines and fields as well. But again, anecdotal.
So it sounds like farmers are kind of taking the matter into their own hands. What are they doing to protect themselves?
Well, most farmers do take water tanks to the field with them, especially those who farm in the areas that tend to be drier. Some take diskers to create fire guards, but I think most just call those in if necessary. I assume, but can't say for sure, that most are cleaning off their combines and other harvesting equipment to limit how much dust is sitting on them and minimize their risk that way.
And I saw in your story that I read, at least some farmers are organizing themselves through social media. Can you tell us a bit about what that looks like and how it helps them respond to fires?
Yes, at least one of the people I spoke to, Jason LeBlanc at Estevan, said farmers in his area had started a group chat a few years ago that they use only when one of them has a fire or some type of emergency. His daughter, Gracie, who is only 13, was driving a combine earlier this month when it caught on fire. Her dad texted the group, and help was on scene within 10 minutes, he said. I think farmers prefer to handle these situations by themselves to avoid the cost of having fire departments attend. Sometimes they obviously need more help, but the bills are high. I have heard of firefighting bills of $6,000 to $7,000. So it's obvious why they would try to organize and put fires out themselves.
Now, this can be a pretty scary situation if you have a piece of equipment go up, especially if, as in the case of Jason LeBlanc, there's a cherished loved one on board. And then of course that's to say nothing of the expense and the time and trouble of, you know, tracking down a new combine and harvest and so on. What's the reaction been of the people who've experienced these fires?
Well, it gives them a good scare, that's for sure. If you look at that case of the LeBlanc family, can you imagine seeing your child in a burning combine? I think they're just grateful, mostly, that no one was hurt. They likely have insurance, so yes, combines are replaceable. How soon you can find one at this time of year, that's another question, and I don't have the answer for that.
At any rate, though, it sounds like it's a big challenge for them when it happens. Well, thanks for joining us, and I hope that the rest of the season is safe for the farmers out there.
I do, too. Thanks a lot.
That was Karen Briere of the Western Producer, filling us in on a spate of combine fires on the prairies. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host, Gord Gilmore. For our next item, we'll be taking a closer look at fall fertilizer management in a special feature sponsored by Smart Nutrition, MAP, and MST from Nutrien. Here's Grain News editor Carrie Belanger and Nutrien agronomist Christy Preston.
Hi, everyone. I'm Carrie Belanger, and I'm the editor of Grain News. And today I'm here with Christy Preston, who has a PhD in soil fertility and is a senior agronomist with Nutrien. Today, we're taking a closer look at your fall fertility program by combining sulfur and phosphorus applications. Christy, welcome.
Thank you, Carrie.
Now, Christy, the last time we talked about fertilizer management, you mentioned more farmers are considering fall applications of sulfur. Are they also shifting to other nutrients such as phosphorus in the fall? And is it for those same reasons?
That's actually a great question, Carrie. And for most farmers, phosphorus applications in the fall came first. So phosphorus is an immobile nutrient in the soil. And what that means is if you get a large rainfall event, the phosphorus is not going to be lost. It's going to be available next spring if it's applied this fall. We are seeing more farmers applying sulfur this fall, but they have to be aware of the source that they use. The sulfate form of sulfur is leachable, and therefore, if it is leached from the soil profile, it's not plant available. And so maybe sticking with an elemental form would be a better option.
What are the advantages of applying both sulfur and phosphorus at the same time?
A lot of times it comes down to management practices. If I can do anything in the fall, say apply fertilizer in the fall, and that frees up some time in the spring, since timing may be constrained due to weather events, when my number one goal is to get the plant in the ground, then anything that I can do this fall to make sure that the nutrients are there next spring is going to be a great resource for increasing my ROI as a farmer.
And are there any benefits with respect to plant uptake of the actual nutrients?
So when we think about applying more nutrients at the same time, there is some benefit, definitely if the plant's uptaking a lot of one particular nutrient. So say phosphorus, for example, the seedling stage of say a corn plant needs that phosphorus to get going. But it also needs sulfur at the same time too. So we do see some interactions there where one nutrient has to be available to maximize the other one. So there is a benefit to applying, say, a multi-nutrient fertilizer product or having a fertilizer product that is capable of being blended with other fertilizers, like say urea or additional MAP. There's always some good options.
How do the fall applications compare to spring applications when we're talking about the availability of plant nutrients? And also, have we covered the forms that both the sulfur and the phosphorus would take?
Phosphorus is present as phosphate in most fertilizers. Sulfur can be present as sulfate or elemental sulfur. Now, when we talk about fall applications, if a fall application of sulfate's made, it may not necessarily be plant available come spring whenever the plant's actively growing, because the sulfate fertilizers carry a high leaching potential. When it comes to comparing fall versus spring applications, a lot of times we see similar yields as long as farmers follow a few general guidelines. So say choosing the right source, maybe choosing an elemental form of sulfur because the oxidation required to make the sulfur plant available into the sulfate form. And also at the same time, waiting for application after the soils begin to cool down. It's a general guideline for applications of nitrogen and sulfur in the fall that soil temperatures drop below, say, 10 degrees Celsius. Below that point, microbial processes slow down. So any process within the soil that is driven by microbes, so say the oxidation of elemental sulfur, those processes are going to slow down. And that's going to allow for, say, your sulfur to be available next spring because it's not being oxidized by the microbes.
And are there any risks to applying these types of products in the fall, ones where you're combining phosphate and sulfur?
So one thing that a farmer might need to consider about fall application, and we've already talked a lot about source, but making sure that you stick with, say, an elemental sulfur source so that it is there and available next spring whenever the plant is actively growing. But one thing to consider is in some of these growing conditions where, say, in Western Canada, the soil temperatures don't necessarily warm up. And we do see a lot of, say, phosphorus deficiency. So if you do make a fall application, we do also suggest that you might apply, say, a starter fertilizer that contains both a phosphorus source and a sulfur as sulfate so that the plant is definitely not limited in the springtime. If you've, say, applied an elemental sulfur in the fall, then that sulfate should be available next spring after the soils warm up above a certain temperature. But by incorporating a starter fertilizer, you're ensuring that phosphorus and sulfur is near the plant, it's available, and it can be taken up, and you can maximize your production that way.
That's a great explanation. Do you have any recommendations for blends? How much AMS would you put down then in that situation in the spring where there are cooler soils?
So for cooler growing conditions, we do recommend that a farmer look at their total sulfur and, well, pretty much their sulfur needs for that particular plant that they're trying to grow and consider applying a blend of, say, ammonium sulfate and Nutrient has a new product called Smart Nutrition Mat Plus MST, where the sulfur is present as micronized sulfur technology, or MST, as the elemental form. Right. And by combining the two sources, you're ensuring that there is sulfur readily available to the plant, but also you'll have that slow release or that longer term availability from elemental sulfur because it has to be oxidized before it's plant available.
And of course, so you mentioned that it's a blend MAP plus MST, so it's got the phosphorus in there as well.
Exactly. Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST carries a fertilizer grade of 943016. So it definitely has a high concentration of both phosphorus and sulfur. And it also offers versatility with fall or spring applications, and it's also a great product for blending in high humid areas, say with urea.
Now, if farmers or agronomists want more information on this, where can they find it?
Farmers and agronomists can definitely find more information on smartnutritionmst.com.
Thanks so much, Christy, and thank you, audience, for listening to this special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Join us again next time for a discussion on soil versus plant mobility and what that means in terms of sulfur deficiency and uptake all season long.
Thanks, Carrie. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore. A bit later, we'll talk to Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm for the latest on commodities. But first, here's Lorraine Stevenson of Country Guide to tell us a bit about recent challenges food banks and others concerned with food security have faced during the pandemic.
Lorraine, thanks for being here.
So how long have tax credits for donated food been around?
I had never actually heard of them myself until I began doing a little bit of reading earlier this year about food donation law in Canada. And they began in Ontario. That was back in 2013, I think. 2013, after the provincial government there amended its Local Food Act. The Ontario Association of Food Banks was behind it at the time. That group is now called Feed Ontario. And it was advocating for a way to support farmers who make food donations to Ontario food banks. So the way it worked was that farmers can claim 25% of the fair market value of the food they donate to eligible community food programs, that is, food banks. And then not long afterwards, Quebec and BC and Nova Scotia also introduced these tax credits for food donations. I'm told that Quebec is the most generous. They will offer 50% of fair market value, or what the farmer would get for that produce in a retail market, like a grocery store.
So that covers four provinces. What happens in all the other provinces? I know there are farmers who are making donations, for example, here in Manitoba, but they don't have this sort of a tax credit. What happens with those?
I'm not aware of one in Manitoba, Gord. I haven't done any follow-up since I wrote this initial article. There may be other tax credits being developed elsewhere, but as far as I know right now, there are no other provinces that have these tax credits. But what was pointed out to me was that farmers in other provinces should be aware that they may be able to obtain some tax benefits from their food donations, because in-kind donations to charities may entitle them to charitable tax donation credits under rules that apply to all donations to charities.
So what has been the reaction to the people who are fighting food insecurity in Canada being? Like, for example, how are Food Banks Canada reacting to this sort of a move?
Well, Food Banks Canada, under quite a bit of pressure, obviously, this year and always, to meet demand, did support the food donation tax credit back in the days when these were starting to roll out. And in fact, in 2016, it had called for an agricultural federal tax credit system. The idea there being that it would provide a small opportunity for Canadian farmers to recoup some of their production costs as they contribute food for redistribution through all food banks. And actually, Canadian Federation of Agriculture supported this as well, and as so did the National Zero Waste Council for its potential to divert waste from landfills. But it was really the pandemic of this year that prompted the federal surplus food rescue program that's just been rolled out recently. And I should point out, Gord, that when I was writing about these food donation tax credits as a support to farmers, that was all before the details of this surplus food rescue program was announced. And it's our colleague, D.C. Fraser, who's done a lot of writing about that new program and how it will buy surplus food from producers. I'm less familiar with that program than D.C. would be. But I've noted he's pointed out that even if the benefit of this new program to producers may be minimal, its purpose is to help feed Canadians, households that are in food insecure, and that's a reason that should become a permanent program.
Now, your story actually mentioned a study that looked at how much of an incentive tax credits are to farmers to donate. What did that study find?
Yeah, that was very interesting. This was a University of Guelph study that was asking some broad questions about how donation tax credits could address both food waste and food insecurity.
pretty detailed work, and I can't go into it in depth here, but one of the things that researchers asked and were told by farmers is that farmers say they were not influenced by a food donation tax credit to make their donation. Now, this was a fairly narrow focus study. These were fresh produce growers in southern Ontario specifically. And what they essentially said was that the primary reason for donating food was because they didn't want to see good food go to waste, and that feeding people is what farmers do. And that study looked at lots of things, but it also identified the fact that any scheme to increase donations of food can create other issues for food banks, namely one being they don't always have storage capacity for larger volumes. So that study's main conclusion was that we should really be rethinking a donation-dependent food bank system in Canada and include looking for ways to help farmers support it.
And I think, unfortunately, you also noted that the need for food banks is unlikely to be going away anytime soon.
Yeah, and we all recognize that. This is not, food insecurity isn't fixed with one program, obviously. Some Canadians can't afford to buy enough healthy food at the best of times, and there's issues around accessibility to it and loss of food skills that factor in there. We saw an uptick in demand that really never dropped after 2008. Food Banks Canada said food banks demand, the demand on food banks decreased about like nearly 30% that year, and it never really dropped back down to pre-recession levels. So what's happening this year, of course, is the pandemic's causing all these job losses, and that's raised the risk of more households potentially falling into that group. So what we saw this year is not likely a temporary blip in food bank demand. And I was just looking today at Food Banks Canada's 2020 report before you called, and it does note that there's been a pretty dramatic decline in volunteers in their ranks, and that food donations this year have also dropped. And that's all in light of increasing public demand for on the food banks. So very difficult times still lie ahead for them, that's for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, thank you for filling us in on that, Lorraine.
Oh, you're very welcome, Gord.
That was Lorraine Stevenson of Country Guide telling us about a tax change that could help meet Canada's food insecurity challenges. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Now, last but not least, here's Markets Farm Glenn Halleck with the latest from the commodity markets. Glenn, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Gord.
So canola's been showing some surprising strength recently. What's been behind that?
Well, there's strong demand for canola. The crushers and the elevators are upping their prices to attract a farmer sale. So, you know, we've seen prices rise on that. Also, there's been a lot of strength coming out of the Chicago Board of Trade soy complex. Soy oil alone, not too long ago was under 30 cents a pound. Now it's about 33, 34 cents. And, wherever soy oil goes, canola always follows.
Yeah, maybe you could explain a little bit of that to us. How does that relationship work?
Yeah, out of all the factors that affect canola, soy oil's got to be one of the largest. If soy oil goes up, canola might lag behind a little bit, but it will nudge up too. The benefit of that, if soy oil does go down, because canola does lag some, it doesn't go down as quickly. So right now, according to the USDA, there's going to be a significant amount of less soy oil this year. So that's driven the price up, and that in turn pulls a canola along with it.
And now, how can we kind of prove that soy has this impact? Are there any things that you watch there, Forex, for example?
Well, we look at the our product values. You know, product values are, from what traders have told me, about $5 to $6 or more ahead of canola. So canola is always trying to catch up to that.
And then just generally, before we wrap up, how's the market been viewing harvest progress this fall?
It's been doing pretty good. You know, even though farmers, they're trying to entice farmers to sell canola, the prices are still going up. The most recent crop reports have about 20 to 25% of the canola off the field. There is a large amount that has been swathed, but there's still some that's still standing. Last week's frost kind of threw a scare into the market. It did that too, helped to nudge up prices. I haven't seen yet any reports that have determined any damages that the frost did cause.
Well, that's great, Glenn. Thanks for joining us and filling us in.
Okay, thanks, Gord.
That's another edition of Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore, saying so long, and we hope you'll join us again next time.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.